is the Things We Do podcast, a podcast about film, life, television, culture, mental health, and all that fun, jazzy stuff. Today, I've got my special guest and friend, Aaliyah Jones. Hello.
Hello. You've got that down, don't you?
I really do.
You took a breath.
Yeah.
And then just gave it.
Look, it's a lot of practice and maybe like almost 4 years of doing this.
It says a lot about your dedication to what you're building here. Is that good?
Well, some people call it insanity, like self-discovery, I guess.
It's all everyone's on that journey.
Yeah,
I honestly think that we're all in a little bit of both of those things.
You want a self-discovery journey right now?
I mean, where's David Attenborough?
Wow. So, Aaliyah, because I'm sure there's people on the internet who do not know of you.
Oh my God. If they did, I'd be scared.
I'm going to give
terrifying,
you...
Terrifying, yeah, I'll be honest.
Give me your pitch. Give me your website pitch. Yeah.
My website is HaaliyahJones.com. It's not built yet, though. It's in the process.
Might be built by the time this comes out.
Probably. I don't know. We'll see. I'll link it in the bottom, in the bio. So my name is Aaliyah Jones. I am an actor, a musician, and a painter. And I now can say that because that's literally like my side hustle income when I'm not on set, which is amazing. I do pet portraits, which has been really freaking cute. I get to stare at pets all day.
That's cute.
Yeah. I don't have to be a waitress, which is like literally the life of an actor until you're, you know, getting offered jobs all the time and whatever, which like I totally, that's the life. That's the life of an actor at the beginning. And I still consider myself very much at the beginning of my career, though I have had some really awesome successes, like being Ethan Hawkins on Lock and Key for 2 and a bit seasons for Netflix, which was like highlight of my career so far, that I was just, oh my God, I still think about it like every day and think of how amazing of an opportunity and time that was. And I've done a few different TV shows and films and whatnot. And I'm just kicking off. I'm just getting started. So that's a little bit about me.
I love that. Getting started, finding it out, working.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, if you don't know Lock and Key, which I feel like is a bit of a weird thing not to know Lock and Key, from its source material of like Joe Hill being like Stephen King's son. And
yeah.
It being,
I feel like if you're in that world, like if you're the kind of person who's, you know, in the comic book world and is interested about that world in general, I think that you would know of Lock and Key even if you didn't watch it or read it. But it is interesting because I've had a lot of conversations where either people are like, oh my God, my family loved that show, but they haven't watched the comics. Or people are like, I read the comics, but I didn't watch the show. Or, oh, I think I saw that on Netflix, but I didn't watch it.
Yeah.
You know, so like it was there, especially during COVID, because it came out February 6th of 2020.
Yeah.
I was in LA when the world started shutting down and I was like, what's happening here? And yeah, like that first season came out and I think everyone was just kind of in their own bubble and wanted things to watch, and just it became way bigger than the smaller community I think might have initially been, you know.
It did feel like it grew and I feel like some other Netflix properties kind of like grew in like popularity during that bubble because we had nothing else to do. And which sounds really sad when we sort of reflect on it. We're like, but it was realistically, I think, the time. And, you know, we're talking season one. And your character is fucking annoying.
I know.
Like, she is just like the most annoying, like, human. She's very like just in your
entitled,
face
entitled in your face, just thinks that she's hot shit. Thank you so much, I appreciate that. That's like exactly what I was going for. Which I mean, you know, you think about like, for example, Game of Thrones Joffrey, like that actor, people hated him because he did a good job.
Yeah.
So I've had people say that about my character, that they didn't like Ethan Hawkins, and I'm like, thank you, I appreciate that, because like that's what I was going for. In season two, though, spoilers, but also it's been out long enough, I have no sympathy.
If you haven't watched it now, this is your fault.
But go watch it if you want to. In season two, I did kind of turn that. I tried to turn that a little on its head because of the fact that, like, there's always something you want to make people love about the people they're supposed to hate, like, or have some sympathy towards them. And I don't know if that came across, but for me personally, like, I did try to infiltrate the demon element of Eden with the human element that felt like she was trapped within herself.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that came across.
I mean, I remember watching it, and this is how bad my memory was between seasons. I forgot that your character got possessed.
Really?
Because I was just like, wow, she's turned worse. Like, she's like now just really demonic. Like, still, and I hadn't
She's stooping low.
Like, I didn't have the, and it took me like an episode in, like season two, episode one. And I was like, at the end, I was like, now let me do some research. Like, yeah. Oh no, she's possessed.
Oh,
this
yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
I didn't key in, even though the dialogue said, like, basically announces she's possessed, because she's like suddenly what, like,
yeah, like Gabe announces that he's gonna repurpose me for Whispering Iron and like boil me down, and I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, you know, that's like inside you. I could just like boil you down into this. So like they give way to it. But if you forget, which I have a horrible memory for these things.
I think it's also like the thing about like Netflix series is like, unless you can skip the recap, which is also like the most hilarious
thing. You
want to
play that game? Sure.
Yeah. And that's what I did. Yeah. So I was like, oh yeah, I remember this show very well. I clearly forgot that your little, like the little oil or whatever. It was like the digital like thing goes in you.
It's Whispering Iron. So it's like, it's the demonic
like glowy
element.
Like it just comes from the portal and goes
woo, and then dissolves into my arm which is crazy. I'm actually doing that exact thing of like not doing the recaps with a book I'm reading right now. It's called Threads of Power by V.E. Schwab, and I will scream from the rooftops. Amazing series called Darker Shade of Magic, and I read this like 2-3 years ago. I blew through them, literally got me back into reading again. Hadn't picked up a book in years. And like, I'm reading this. I'm like, maybe 100 pages in, and I'm like, how did we get here? Because it's like in the same universe. Like, the characters are here with new characters and whatever. But I'm like, this is 7 years later. I'm like, wait, I don't know what's happening here.
Well, that's kind of like the thing. And I feel like this is also, I don't know, maybe it's the attention span of our generation, which is a little bit appalling. But I remember also like films now and, you know, like stories now, they are shorter and they are more condensed. Mm-hmm. And and I think it's also why my wife and I, we watched Rosemary's Baby recently, which I was like, oh, that's a classic film. I didn't realize how long it was. It's like 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Oh.
It's long.
I just watched the whole extended director's cut of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
My partner and I watched each one in two parts. I think we did The Return of the King in three.
Yeah.
Like, because it's like 5 hours long. Yeah. But the thing with those films is they're so, like, they also have very specific cut points or like intermission points, which I don't think you have as much. Like, they have very distinct act one, act two, act three.
Yeah.
Which makes it easy to cut or like take a break or whatever and come back, which we don't really have much of anymore. We kind of barrel through things. But yeah, they're like, my attention was amazing because it was slow. Even though it was, I mean that in the way of like, I think a lot of things right now are edited really quickly, where it's just like, I get overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
And then my attention drifts to other things like doom scrolling. But like watching Lord of the Rings, it's like the cuts are longer and it's more like gripping, like in other ways.
I think it's the appeal. And I guess like, I'll go a little bit into this, why you wanted to become an actor. But you know, like it's the appeal, I guess, from like slow driven stories. And I almost feel like we're going in this really weird direction where like TV is trying to up its budget to be like a long format film, but then it's like too long and too convoluted. Like, and it's really interesting because the prime example, Harry Potter, now going to HBO to do, I think, like 8 seasons.
Oh my god! Just like there's sorry, I talked to the mic. There are so many other IPs out there that could be created. Like,
don't give JK more money.
Literally. Like, and also just leave a good thing alone. It was of that time. Since then, a lot of shit's come out that it's just like, why are we? We can leave those in a little box and just like appreciate them for what they are. There is so much, like, I look at, you know, Greek mythology and like a lot of different stories that have happened over the millennium. Like, you know, like it's, there's so much there that we could take from and make new ideas from, and new shows and new TV shows, movies and whatnot. And they just go back and back and back. We saw this with Marvel, to what sells. But the problem is, I don't know if that's selling as well anymore because people are kind of bored of it, you know?
I will. Even the biggest diehard fans of Marvel have stopped watching a lot of the content.
Yeah, like, take a hint. Like, and it sucks because, like, I know how brilliant those were. I'm not personally, like, a huge Marvel-verse fan, but I know how important those were to people. And just to see it kind of being, like, you know, ground into the abyss is a bit hard to watch because it's, like, just there's – you guys have the – ability to do so much more than just do this over and over and over and over and over again, you know? I don't know.
Oh, I you're like too much going
anyway,
on.
Anyway, my brain, I'm neurodivergent.
I mean, like, particularly, and we'll go into that. We're going to go straight into that little can of
worms. Oh, yeah. When we first started talking about even doing this podcast, we were on a phone for like an hour just talking about what we might talk about.
I know.
So, like, I know we'll figure out our way through this.
I love that. I mean, particularly also, I do want to talk about you being an actor and also...
Eventually, yeah.
Well, I mean, like, particularly, I want to interrogate you about that now. I like you, like, eventually, in 3 hours.
How do you play a bitch? How do you do it so well?
No, but I mean, like, what... The two simple questions. Yeah. How do you do a bitch so well?
Yeah.
No, why? Why acting? Why, you know, why that particular avenue for you?
Simply, I just did not want to go to university. No, honestly, ever since I was a kid, I've been an entertainer and I've been really interested in the arts. And I feel like I've said this so many times in my life, but it really is my villain origin story. when I was in high school, I went to Earl Haig Secondary School. And they have something called the Claude Watson program, which is like an arts program. And they have like mini Claude, which is for, you know, middle school kids. And I auditioned for that, didn't get into that. So I went to, like, you know, a normal person school. And then in high school, I auditioned for the vocal program for grade 9. And I was like, oh, I'll probably get in. Like, I'll be a Nepo baby here. My dad was part of building this arts program, whatever. Didn't happen for me. So, like, even my little shred of Nepo babyism that I could have used, it was like, no. Because I didn't know, I didn't sing classical music and I didn't really do theory. And I also just was shit at school. And they were like, we're not going to give you, like, an extra workload of being in the arts program. Same thing happened in grade 10. I auditioned to be in the drama program. Didn't get into that. And so over and over again, I just kept getting beat down about, like, trying to do arts and just being turned away because of my academic lack of success. Because I was undiagnosed ADHD and I just wasn't a good student. So that affected art because it had to be balanced in school and I just wasn't able to balance it. So when I graduated high school, I was like, I'm not going to university. I don't want to do this. I know I'll be depressed for the next 4 years. So I went to Australia and I was an au pair for a bit. And an important part of the story, though, was in grade 11, Degrassi came to our school for an open call. And the whole hallway was filled with, like, drama students and people auditioning. It was like 500 kids. And long story short, I was one of 4 people who got a callback. And I remember being in that line and a kid asking me what I was doing there. Like, so why are you here? And I'm like, I'm auditioning. And they're like, oh. You know, like, that kind of petty BS. And, like, that really hurt. But then when I, like, I remember getting the email and it saying, like, you have a callback and going, like, fuck you guys. And it really propelled me forward to just be like, okay, even though these people say I can't, I can, because professionals are taking me seriously. Yeah. So I went to Australia, I did all that, and then I just kind of started getting involved with like student stuff. My friends were in student programs, film programs, so I started doing films for them. And then I got an agent. I booked my first audition, which was crazy. It was for Working Moms. I had no lines. I was just a sassy Pilates teacher. I think that's like season two. I don't know where, but you'll see me. And then I just like kept on auditioning, and I was like, wow, this is easy. It's not. and then I booked Lock and Key about a year and a half into auditioning, which was just like huge. Mm. I didn't even realize, like, I remember saying to my agent, wow, this is cool. I guess other like casting directors will see that I booked something. Like, that's good. I'll get more auditions. And my agent was like, I think this is in a different stratosphere, Halia. Like, I think this is like really big. This is for Netflix. And Netflix was like a thing, but it wasn't like something that was super on my radar as like, you know? So I got into it mainly because I just kind of, I didn't want to go the traditional route. I was constantly pushed in that direction not by my parents ever. They were very supportive, but like a lot of my peers in high school, basically saying like I would amount to nothing if I didn't go to university. And I was like, I'm going to prove you wrong. And now I'm literally like a vocalist, an actor, and a painter. And there's like a visual arts program that I like tried so hard to like impress the visual artists when I was in high school. And they were like, you know, I just feel like I kind of came out the other side successful because of the fact that I just didn't let them get me down.
Yeah.
In the long run. At the time they did, for sure. But after a while, it was just like, this is what I want to do more than anything. I'm just going to go and do it and see how it happens.
Yeah, which is really, this kind of like the best result, and also like fuck everyone who doubts you. I think it's also like the clearly the most ADHD coded story. Like
100%. I can't focus on anything more than like a couple of weeks. So like to have an agent who's consistently like sending me things is great, because I'm like, okay, like I have someone, you know, putting me in positions that, you know, compared to going out and doing other things by myself.
I think that it's also like, and a lot of my friends who are, you know, like actors in Australia as well, they're the same. They're trying to find agents that will suit them. Like there's sort of like a weird thing where I think you go through the stage of like you outgrow your agent or you change agents.
Agent just got a felony charge for stealing $800,000 from their clients, so that's why I outgrew my agent. I left them.
I mean, like that's tea. A minimum. Yeah,
that's tea. I can say it because it's on like newspapers and stuff.
Amazing, though.
Like, I was top of their roster. I was like friends with them. Like I not friends with them, but like you know. I liked them a lot, and then shit hit the fan over a weekend, and I was like, damn, okay, damn. I got him.
Bye.
And I had luckily been finished Lock and Key at that point, but like, yeah, it was some tea.
And there's a sort of like discussion now, I think, on online forums and stuff, where it's like a lot of my friends are representing themselves, which is another rat.
It's really hard.
It's so hard. Like, I'm not saying do it.
No, my neurodivergent brain could never.
But I do think that, like, and a lot of the thing I also think, and my father-in-law asked me this question because we were watching a film, and you know, he was like, how many actors actually make it? And we Googled. We did the Google search.
Really?
It's like 1% of the whole world like well-known names.
Of course.
And you sort of like statistically look at that. That's horrifying. But it doesn't mean you've never acted in your life. I think the thing that I always love, and I think like I look at anyone's career when you sort of discover names and you go, oh, this person was great in this. And you know, there's always like milestones that actors go through. There's like their golden era or like an artist's golden era. It's like there's the dry spell of like maybe, you know, like I think Daniel Day-Lewis is the only weird one who is like ever
being
consistent. Every 7 years he'll come out of retirement and be like, I did carpentry and now I'm gonna do a film.
But he got to that point through trial and tribulation, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like I don't know his IMDb that well, but whenever I feel down on myself, excuse me, because I am in a dry spell right now. Until recently, and I'm very grateful to be working on something in the new year. I was not booking anything, anything. And I came off of Lock and Key hot. Like, I was feeling good about my work. I was getting really built up with really kind compliments and support and whatnot. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, I'm going to go and book something. And this is going to my career is going to take off even more than this. Like, and I was also like, I was in LA, like looking at billboards on Sunset Avenue with like Lock and Key on it and being like, holy shit, I'm in that. Like, wow, I've made it. I've had my moment. I've made it. And that was just the beginning. Like, it's crazy to think like everything goes and flows and it's like ups and downs and like finding that way to it. I don't think you make it until you get to that like Daniel Day-Lewis point where you can choose your projects and you can take that time off to do carpentry and that's fine. But that takes a long time. And whenever I get down on myself about going through a dry period, I go to IMDBs. I go to people's IMDBs and I go, when did they start? How many years did it take until they got their first notable role?
Yeah.
And most of the time it's 10 years. I'm only 6 years in.
Yeah.
So I'm okay. Like, I'm very lucky and I feel very grateful for where I've gotten to so far. But I still have years of work and it will be work after that too to uphold the career that I want, because it's a career. It's something that I'm building constantly and there's no ABC. Like, it's all over the place and you never know when it's going to hit. Like, I could get a call today or no, on Monday. That would just like, they don't call on Saturdays unless it's like something really special. But I mean, I could get a call on Monday that could just completely change my life.
Yeah.
And that happened to me a few months ago. Like, something I auditioned for in December, I did a call back in January. And then in July, they were like, hey, remember that thing you auditioned for months and months and months ago? They want you to come to Vancouver for an in-person screen test. And I'm like, what? I haven't even thought about that in like several months. So it's like the world as an actor is so up and down. And like, anytime I'm down on myself, just go check out IMDb. It's so interesting because some people also have really, really, really amazing periods and then nothing. And that could be by choice or it could just be because you burn out sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's also really healthy to kind of like go in ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. I think like, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I think it's like when I hit my peak, I then like had a momentary, and like a lot of my projects, like the podcast and stuff, was self-made. Like, I didn't have like producers or anything. I think that was like the biggest thing to convince it, because I was starting out with friends and then I was like, okay, well, I've got to have a reputable bank of stuff I've done. That's the only way you improve your skills, you keep working, you make more stuff. And I think particularly it was like, you know, I never thought in a million years that, you know, like I'd sit down with some, you know, people and be like, oh God, I get to actually talk to people who I feel have had a career. And not to say some of my friends haven't, they've had amazing careers, but it did feel like I was getting more reputable, like as a source of an interviewer. And I think particularly like during 2023, I was overworking and burning out. So I had the opposite problem where I was just like, I was doing too much. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh God, I don't have any help. And that's kind of like the thing that also you need to constantly damage as an artist. Like, it's like, and now I'm at the other side where I'm like really excited to do projects again. Mm-hmm. But that always takes like, I think, rejigging your brain, because it's like, as we say, what do we love and why do we keep wanting to do it? Which I think, you know, like, life is too short not to do something you love. And I think that's a really big thing. And I look at like, one of my favorite things is always looking at, you know, careers where it's like you watch someone's first movie, like their first, like Peter Jackson or, you know, like Alfred Hitchcock or like even Greta Gerwig's like first film. Like all of them, I'm sorry, they're all shit. Like,
of course
they
are.
Terrible.
That's how you learn. And I mean, Quentin Tarantino has spoken very openly about this, about how if you want to become a filmmaker, don't go to school. Go and spend the money you're going to go spend on school and make a shitty film.
Yes.
Because you are going to learn more making a shitty film than you are sitting behind a desk. And that's different for everyone, because some people really enjoy academics and like sure, yeah. go to school if you want to go to school for that. But I have learned more on set than anything. Mm. But you have to start out doing shitty things in order to learn what's right and what's wrong. You know, what works and what doesn't. Everyone has to do that. And I think if you start out strong, you're gonna fuck up eventually.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna know how to deal with that. And I think with the success of Lock and Key, you know, and I don't know, maybe if this is me justifying like having a hard couple years, but I think there's also conceptualizing the fact that maybe I needed this time, a down period, to recognize how good it can be and to appreciate the career I'm in and understand how to navigate the low periods, because I didn't really have that. Like Lock and Key hit pretty early on in my career. And if it kept on going up and up and up, I think I probably would have been a dickhead. You know,
yeah.
Like I think I needed that. I needed the rose colored glasses to come off to see like this industry is difficult, and to have like empathy towards people who like everyone who takes time in this industry to come up, because it's not easy. So yeah, like for me, I discovered that I can paint pet portraits and I can make money doing that when I'm not working. Even if I'm like, you know, the bank account's doing okay, like it's good to still have something to rely on that I enjoy. And I feel very lucky that I've had this time to discover that. And I'm not, you know, because for so long it was like, oh, well, the only way that I can make good money is by acting. And then I would stress about it. And that would just get me down, and it made me fight against my joy for acting. So that time away from acting has been really so full of self-growth and discovering self-worth beyond the projects that, you know, could be given to me, or not given to me, but like I could be in and whatnot. Like I'm more than just an actor, and that this time off has really offered me that opportunity to learn who I am without being on set. Even though I love me when I'm on set, I'm the happiest bean ever. I'm so happy when I'm on set,
which is so lovely as well. And I love what you say about like having that time off and at reflection. I think we all need that. I think one of my the same thing happened to me, and I think like even currently, like I've changed, you know, I've now have a mundane 9-to-5 job to kind of fuel income, because there was like, and I think I needed that, you know, like I came to Canada thinking I've got these skill sets that I've had in Australia that, you know, like are really good, I'm gonna bring them over here and people are gonna love my work. And no, it was complete opposite. It was just brick walls. It was nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think it was kind of like the slap in the face that I needed to be like, okay, well, get off your high stool, like get off the pedestal, and realize what your strengths are. And one of my friends managed to get me a job at a company she worked at. And I was like, cool, I'll do this, do it for about a year. And that's my mentality. I'm like 5 weeks in, but it's like, it's good money. It's decent money, 9-to-5 Monday to Friday. But then outside of that, I get to do fun things. I'm like, okay, well, I've got to remind myself, it's not the shift work I was doing before where it was all over the clock and I had no energy. Like it's normal hours. I can do that. And then over time, this does not take away my love and passion for the arts and wanting to make films and lead production companies and, you know, actually go back in acting and do voice acting myself. Like it's one of those things that I think we sort of steer, we kind of kid ourselves, we kind of go, oh, well, I haven't made it by A, so why bother anymore? And it's like, well, you've got to constantly keep bothering, because that's the thing. It's like proving, and I think that's such a neurodivergent way of thinking as well. It's like fucking too true. But I feel like this is the thing through life, through everyone, the amount of people that I've met who are like way more like stuck up and difficult and everything, like who have never, like they've done one film, they've done a short film with their friend and they go, I'm the best shit. And I'm like, are you? Like, you've come straight out of drama school, you've come straight out of uni. Mm-hmm. Like, I get that you all want to be filmmakers, but no one's going to be that high horse. Like, and I think the realization is, film sets are the best place to be. They are so much fun, but they're also the most grueling time.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And a lot of the time is you've got to switch on and you just got to suddenly everyone's been like, okay, break's over. We got to get back to work. Otherwise we're not going to meet.
Yeah.
You know, the figures, you know, like all these scenes today, we've got like 5 scenes to shoot and people go, oh yeah, no, you know, and I've been on set where like some of my friends' films were just like, oh yeah, we'll take our time. And like, no, we've got to get stuff.
Time is money.
Yeah. Time is money and cut shots. Like the amount of times where you know, and that like, my favorite ever story was someone who had never been on a big film set was like, oh, this will never happen on a big film set. I was like, are you kidding me? Like the amount of times that things go wrong on big film sets and they have to cut scenes, they have to cut shots, they have to cut like entire hours of the day and then just go, okay, we're clocking off at 5. We have to do either pick this up tomorrow or we're not doing it at all.
Yeah.
And that's the realization and the amount of rewrites and everything. And it's so funny that every like, and this is the life I've dealt with as a producer. And I remember one of my friends who entered her amazing short film into like a few Australian film festivals and it went into a couple of international ones and it did really well. I remember the day we started at 10 a.m. We finished at like 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. It was a very long day. And we had like probably like 2 days. There was one day she didn't finish till 4 a.m. Like she was shooting her own stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember the next day, people were like, oh, this would never happen. Like someone who had never been on a real set.
And
I was like, everything's never, you know, you can be the first AD and the best first AD. Things are going to go over.
Yeah.
Like it's just reality.
The best ADs are the first ADs. First of all, I think first ADs are the most important people on sets a lot of the time. I mean, every single person is important in their own right, but like a bad first AD, you will feel it through the whole set.
Oh, yeah.
But like they're important to like, they're basically steering the ship. Like the director is kind of painting the picture of where you're going and like, you know, where to go and how to go and like what everyone's, you know, but the first AD is like damage control and like they have one of the hardest jobs. And I've been on film sets where the first AD was green. And by the end of the day, I had to take them aside because I was the most I was asked to be on the film because of my resume. And like, I was the one who had worked and this was more of like a starter film for the filmmakers.
Yeah.
And I took them aside and I was like, because I knew that they would respect my input because they wanted that otherwise. And I was like, when do you guys go into overtime? And they're like, 45 minutes ago. And I'm like, what? And you want to do one more scene and the other room isn't even set decked yet. Like, you need to call it right now. It's the first day. You're not going to make half of your days in 2 weeks if the first AD doesn't have a backbone. And I was like, you can do it kindly, but don't be nice on like how you do things. You have to be strict about them and say, no, we have to move on. I'm sorry. We've got what we can work with. We have to move on. Mm. Or it just goes all to the shitter. Like,
oh yeah.
And everyone gets exhausted from that when you don't have any direction. Because they're just waiting around like, what do I do next? What's next for us? You know? And like, it's grueling. It can be really, really grueling. I love it. I've been really, really great. Like, I've had really, really great experiences on sets so far. So I don't have a lot of horror stories, but like, I've seen my fair share of shit.
I think I only ever have like one and it was run by me, but it was the only horror story I remember. And like, I think it was self-funded. It was very like low-key. We shot it like just before we left Australia. And I remember we had 15 people in our house. Like we were shooting in our own house. We were trying to do a fake trailer for a spoof like idea. And everyone was trying to get, like everyone tried to have their own input. It was really quite funny. Because they were like, yeah, I know. It was a lot of that. But I remember there was one actor who did not like the rest of the actors, which caused a lot of friction.
Oh my God, yeah.
And that was also the hardest thing. And I think it was like suddenly, like there was a lot of, you know, people's personal lives started coming into this. And I was like, I remember we got to the end of the day and my dear wife, who I love very much, and she used to be a soundie, so she was very much like, she was like, I left sound like sets like this because she was like, just people exhausting. Annoyed me. But I do remember I was talking to my DOP, and there was something like, I remember I said to my first, I was like, oh, can you go and make sure this is set up, like the next scene, and she was trying to get him to move, but he wasn't moving fast enough while I was outside dealing with something else. And I just realized, it was like, it doesn't matter what you do if people are not switched on. And like, you know, even when the thing is like, sometimes it is down to the fact that the space is not big enough. Yeah. And that is,
there's so many like hurdles to jump over.
But the one thing I remember, because I was the director and producer, everyone blamed me for it not being good enough. And I remember going, I was like, okay, guys, it's not just my fault. It's everyone's input. Like, if one person is to blame, then that's terrible. But it's actually everyone's responsibility.
It's never one person unless someone's specifically being like really difficult to work with. And that's why, like on set, I am a firm believer that if you come in with the best attitude and like this curiosity and this desire to, you know, make the best product and in the best time and, you know, just build a community, that's going to have the best end product. And I think that's why Lock and Key was such a like unicorn set. Like I had multiple crew members say that Lock and Key was a unicorn set in the way that everyone got along. And of course there was dramas here and there, but like us as actors like didn't really hear about it. I only heard about things because like I became friends with makeup artists and like the costume artists. Like, so it's, yeah, like it doesn't always happen, but I think when you come into a set with the best intention and with just like hoping to have the best time, that's the best remedy for a great film.
Yeah.
But like shit can still go wrong and it can be an incredible time and it can still be poo poo.
Oh yeah, I think one of the best like critiques I've ever got as an artist, and also this is very neurodivergent as well. And one of my friends was like, she was like, you always make gold. The problem is like, it's just seeing how the lines always line up is like sometimes watching someone finish half a jigsaw and then you show, because she's like, your quality of work is always like up here.
Yeah, you have high expectations.
But the problem is like, you look at it and people just kind of think it's like, oh, I guess we're going to hamstring this together. And it's like, well, that's sometimes the only way. Like sometimes it's just feed your crew, like feed your, and I remember particularly pre-COVID, actually this was like the biggest thing I'd ever tried to work with. It took me like two and a half years. It's actually getting revitalized soon.
Nice.
But it was a anthology horror series. And I remember we had budgeted it. And I remember I felt like I was working. It was the first time I had tried to have a team of like, okay, well, I've got a few friends who are producers and stuff like that. But I ended up feeling like it was one of those things where I was like, I felt like I was the only one with a realistic budget in mind, and everyone else was like, oh, we can cut corners here. And I was like, there is no way we can cut corners. Yeah. Like, there's some things I was like, we, you know, this needs to be a real location unless we build it, or it's going to cost this much. And it was the most hilarious time. And I think it was kind of great because COVID happened. It got shut down very quickly because we were like, well, we can't shoot it during a pandemic. Yeah. And it gave me time to sit down and go, okay, well, I had so many opinions coming in. What do I want to make? Yeah. You know, what at the end of the day is going to be this product? And I think that's where I enjoy, because COVID really forced me to slow down. It forced that whole, like, you know, as ADHD, your brain goes a million miles a minute and people go, oh, you know, like can't keep up. It's great. Like it's the other side where it's like, oh, I get to focus and really hone my skills and go, well, this is great. I'm going to inform my knowledge on this. Like I learned color grading during that COVID period. Like learn how to edit audio, learn how to do a bunch of stuff. So I felt like I didn't have knowledge before that of the full picture of a filmmaking, you know, because
going back to what we were talking about, you gotta make shit before you make gold. You really have to go through that experience in order to understand what works and what doesn't work, and like now you know that you need to sit down with yourself and say, what do I want, and not take the opinions of like five other people
who would,
unless they have good intentions or like, you know, they have way more experience than you, then sometimes that is appreciated because you have a lot to learn still. All of us do. Even the best filmmakers still have things to learn. But it's like that willingness to learn is one of the most important things. And like, whether it's with other people or by yourself, it's like taking that time.
I mean, like, here's a really in-depth question for you as a neurodivergent person. But I mean, like, have you felt that a lot of people kind of like put you into a certain category because, you know, like you have ADHD, or, you know, were you ever kind of like considered the weird kid or the different kid growing up?
You're like, undiagnosed, but I think that was other issues. So I'm not even going to say, but like, I think nowadays I can look at a lot of things and like why I struggled with certain friendships or and I even like understanding my sexuality too. Like I now I'm like, oh, maybe that's why I struggled with having female friendships growing up. Like now looking back on it, like, oh, it was ADHD, it was sexuality, it was this, it was that. Like, you know, like understanding that these things have taken have been a part of my life for so long undiagnosed. And to understand now how to navigate them is like reworking a lot of my brain. Yeah. It's affected so many parts of my life.
I mean, like, do you feel like the milestones of your life have like really then shifted, like, you know, the way you sort of see friendships now as an adult?
Totally. What's really interesting, actually, I've recently in the last like several months made two new girlfriends who like I met them through their boyfriends. Like they are in the music scene and whatever. And they it's so cool to have good girlfriends that like I feel like I'm a part of something. Cause like I've always had like one-off girlfriends and like, you know, like my best friend Michelle, who is on the West Coast filming right now. And like, you know, I've had different close friends that are just like one-offs, but I've never really felt like I've been a part of a positive group. Like that I understand now. Like growing up I was, and it just wasn't, it didn't work out well. I think because I didn't know a lot about myself and I didn't know how to navigate having ADHD and how that affects relationships, because it really, really does. And I'm still learning that. But now I'm a lot more honest with myself and a lot more willing to just be like, ooh, that didn't come across right. Or like, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to navigate having those good friendships and relationships. So that my ADHD doesn't affect them. And like looking back on my childhood, it really did. And I made mistakes and I did things that I probably like, I didn't even know why, but it was because I was incredibly neurodivergent and had no support in that realm. And it's not because my parents were like, no, that doesn't exist. It was because we didn't know. We just didn't know. Like I got tested when I was 10 and they said it could be mild. And my mom's like, I would string that guy up. Like, she's so like, I wish that he had done more thorough testing on you, because it wasn't until I was in grade 12 that I officially got diagnosed. And I was already like, I'm not going to university because I can't pay attention in class. And like, it had already affected my life so negatively that it was so, I remember being mad when I got diagnosed because I didn't know earlier. And now every time like I learn something new about ADHD, I'm like, wow, would I still have those friendships if I had known better of myself? Would I have navigated them more? Would I have, you know, all of these what ifs, like those people aren't in my life now because of a lot of things that I didn't understand about myself. And I've learned from that since. So having new friendships now has been so exciting, because when things go wrong or like, you know, when there's hard conversations, I'm so much better at being honest, at being like, you know, I had a conversation with one of the girls the other day and she's like, is there something going on between us? Like, is there something like wrong or whatever? I'm like, not that I'm aware of. And she's like, yeah, you just like seem like you're way more quiet. I'm like, girl, I haven't texted my mom in like a week. Like I haven't talked to Michelle in like 2 weeks. Like, it's nothing personal. It's just that I like time blindness is such a big thing in my life where like I can go weeks without talking to a friend and then we sit at coffee and it's like no time has passed, at least in my mind.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it's necessary to keep up with friends every single day. Like I don't have long text conversations. I don't have long phone calls with people. Like, but if I'm sitting across from them, that's where I can like really tune in and like connect with that person. So I think that might have been a part of like growing up and, you know, just not having that closeness with people because I'm so happy to be on my own too, you know? So yeah. Does that answer that?
I love that. No, I'm the same. I think it's also something that I've grown up and realized as I got older, because I was diagnosed at 5.
Mm.
And like, I think in knowing that I had the opposite problem where my mom assumed I'd grew out of it.
Mm.
And I didn't realize how much it impacted my adulthood as well, because I was getting into situations where I was like, I can't understand why this situation is like difficult for me or, you know, like.
Yeah. It's not hard for anyone else. No, why am I struggling? Like,
yeah.
Taxes.
there was a great ad I remember actually talking about taxes that did talk about like people with, you know, because there are some great tax ads. But it was talking about people with like, you know, blindness towards due dates and stuff like that. I have that all the time. I just forget. I just kind of like go, oh shit, fuck. If it's not in my calendar, I will forget.
Yeah.
I
had to call the CRA and be like, girl, it's coming. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. Like, I still think that we're in January or like of last year. Like,
yeah,
I'm
I know.
So sorry. Yeah, she knows me now.
But I do think that's kind of like the thing of like, you know, you come into it now and you just kind of get like paranoid about it. But I remember particularly like one of my best friends who's known me for like 14 years now, like we met in high school, like, and we became like kind of like it was a friendship that also took time because like we were both on the spectrum and both had ADHD and like it was one of those things, but that kind of worked out, and we both like catch up maybe once every 3 months. Like she lives in Australia, so it's even when I was there, I would see her maybe once every 3 or 6 months. Like, and she's my best friend, and I was like, and some people who I saw as more of acquaintances, I would see more regularly.
Yeah, and I wonder where that is because I'm the same.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I kind of the thing is, and I don't know if you've discovered this as an adult, which I find I'm more excited by neurodivergent people than I am from neurotypical people, which is...
Of course, they're scary.
Neurotypical
They've got people. Their life together, I'm, and that's boring.
But it's also, like, a little bit... And, you know, and it was the thing about, like, my own sexuality and my own identity. A lot of that came out of, like, when I pulled myself out of, like, just being ADHD, and then I came to, you know, appreciate everything. Because a lot of it, like, a lot of it you don't think of. Like, a lot of it just sits in the background and just goes, oh.
Yeah. You're like, why is my life falling apart in all these ways? And then you learn and you're like, whoa, oh my God, I could literally just be doing this, 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 and, you know, maybe get medicated and this, this, you know, whatever. And like I went on Wellbutrin for depression. It changed my life.
Oh, wow.
And it doesn't work for everyone, but like it's for ADHD a little bit as well. It's helped with my ADHD. And like Vyvanse for my ADHD was horrible for me.
Yeah.
Like I was on like 50 milligrams and I was like buzzed out of my mind or sleeping and like no in between. And it just wasn't working for me. But now I, instead of like focusing on the medication part, I'm like focusing on the structure part.
Yeah.
And trying to implement structures into my life that can help me better serve myself, my purpose, and my career and whatnot. But that doesn't happen every day. Like, oh my God, I love doom scrolling because it's ADHD like euphoria.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's amazing. Which is, it sucks. But yeah, like understanding yourself at a deeper level can like help in so many different areas of your life. And you don't even know it until you start doing it. And it's hard work. It's not easy. It doesn't just like happen overnight. But I mean, discipline is the worst thing for me. Like, I'm very undisciplined unless I'm, like, very focused on something, you know? And then I'm like, don't talk to me. I'm not doing anything else except for this one thing. So, like, that's other thing. Like, learning, okay, if I'm not good at discipline, how can I influence myself in other ways to get things done and do this, blah, 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 you know?
I think that's very, like, crucial as well. And a lot of the thing that makes me laugh, you know, like, in terms of my own experiences with it is like structure. Like, I have a morning routine, and this was taught to me by like one of my therapists, but she was like, it's really important when you're on the spectrum, like, to have a routine, like a little. And it's so interesting when someone tries to interfere with that routine. Like, every morning I make coffee for myself, and I make coffee for my wife, and that is like, and, you know, do that, and that's my first thing I do. Like, that's, like, the general routine. And we sort of have a routine now. But I remember, like, some, you know, if something was thrown off, and she knows this now. She knows me so well now. But I remember, like, once she tried to, like, introduce a little change, and she just saw me, like, spiral and get lost in what I was trying to do. And I was like, I'm like, it's not your fault. Like, my brain just needs to switch on, get ahead of itself, and then like be like, I have tasks, I have, like, you know, and then I can sit in chaos. Like, I can sit in a messy room working hard on photos or ideas and I'm fine. Yeah. But, you know, like, some people, like, just can't. Like, I feel like during COVID I lived on my own, which was, you know, a really eye-opening thing. Yeah, like, I feel that was, and I went on, like, did the whole thing before I met wife. I went on, like, dating apps and, you know, like,
oh, I can't put up with them. I can't do it. I just can't. But go on.
Well, it's just hilarious to me now because I look back at it and I just go, well, you know, it was the most unfriendly place for, like,
oh my God, yeah, for sure.
And, but, you know, like, people go in, like, and I feel like during, I don't know, like, I don't know if you've noticed this, like, post-COVID, everyone's social skills have gone, like, from shit. Yeah. Like, completely, like, no one knows how to interact.
Because you can't edit live. You can't. Like, people are so used to, like, texting and commenting on social media and stuff like that. And, like, it's just, like, sorry, I'm so far away from this. Human interaction is so hard now because we've been so disconnected. I think it will be a pendulum that swings back eventually. But 100% it's been affected, of course.
Do you feel like you're more, like, social now or less?
Less.
Really?
Yeah. Don't talk to me.
I'll go away.
literally at podcast.
Yeah.
I'm not as social. I'm not as social. I'm not as, like, go get 'em as I used to be. And I think I'm wondering if that might be part of Lock and Key as well, of coming off of that. Like, before Lock and Key, I was like, I hustled way more when it came to, like, modeling or acting or, like, you know, being in short student films or whatever. But since COVID specifically, I also met my partner in 2022. So, like, at the tail end of COVID, not really COVID anymore, but, like, right when I shaved my head, which was about 2 years now. And since moving in with him specifically, like, he moved in a year ago, like, I'm so happy to stay home. Like, I don't want to go out and be in a loud room and spend $50 on fruity cocktails and, like, yell to people I have no interest in talking to. Like, it's just, and then it'd be like spit in my ear. Like, I can't do that. I get so overstimulated now. When before I used to, like, have fun doing that. Like, I especially noticed it at TIFF where I was like, I'm going to show up to be seen, not to be like, not to stay here for long. Like, it's more so to just be like, I'm still in the world of acting. Like, I'm still here, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not a necessity for me to go to every single thing. Like, I'll go to the ones where I'm going to be connecting with people I know or they have other people to introduce me to or whatever. But I'm not searching for a party anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that's also age too. I mean, I'm 27 and, like, I've never been someone, my mom even said when I was a kid, I didn't like loud noises and I always knew when to go to bed. It was always like, I always knew my time and I'm like that now. And I think COVID really brought that forward for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it really taught me that I like going to bed at a specific time. I like, you know, having my own space, and I don't really feel the need to go out and socialize every single day anymore. You know,
yeah.
I like my time.
It's so interesting that you say that as well. I'm the same. Like, I like, one of my favorite things to do is sit at home and watch a movie with my wife. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like we dedicate almost every night to a movie night.
That's what happens when you live with your best friend. It's amazing. I met this guy at a park and now I can't get rid of him.
But I mean, like, it's honestly like the best thing. But it's so funny because, you know, people go, oh, that could be boring and stuff. I'm like, oh, you know what though? It's not. Like, there's nothing about it that's boring.
I wouldn't be doing it if I was boring.
No.
You know?
And I do think there's sort of like this, I think we get into this sort of like fear as we get older that, you know, we're surrounded by, like, you know, people, or we, you know, but I'm like, I literally talk to my wife every day, and she's my best friend, like, out of everyone. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I talk to all my friends, or sometimes I talk to, like, random people, or sometimes I get to, mm-hmm. but I'm like, I'm never bored. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll know when I'm bored, and that's, mm-hmm. like, when I'm, you know, like, not stimulated. Mm-hmm. But that is never a time where I'm always like, oh, I could go and edit a photo, or I could go and do this, or, you know, or I could write an idea down, mm-hmm. or I could go for a walk with my wife, or we could watch a movie, like, all these things. And then people go, oh, do you want to come out? And I'm like, this is the thing I'd least like to do.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, it's funny now as well. And this is, I hate parties and I hate crowded rooms. I would rather hang out with people one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I love going for coffee with friends, mm-hmm. spending a couple of, like, going back to that thing we were saying, it's like, we've always caught up. There's one friend of mine, I see her probably every 3 years, mm-hmm. We always go back to that conversation, and just, like, no time's changed, and just have coffee. And she always makes the joke of, like, oh, how did we, like, I feel like we've been talking for 10 minutes, but it's been like 2 hours. I'm like, yeah, that's just like standard.
I like house parties that don't have really loud music. Like, I don't understand. Okay.
That was very specific.
Stay with me here. Okay. I got a bone to pick. If you're having a house party and, like, the music is so loud that I'm having to yell to the person who's standing right beside me, I'm like, dude, this is your house. Like, you can control the levels. It's not like a DJ trying to, like, get the speakers out across the whole club or whatever. Like, I'm literally standing in your kitchen and I can't hear the person beside me.
Mm.
And I just, that drives me crazy, because I'm like, house parties are small and they're intimate. And I'm like, I'm there to actually talk to people. Like, at a club, you're there to dance and whatever. I don't know. I haven't been to a club in a while. But like, but like, at a house party, it just feels like, why are we yelling at each other? And I don't like that. I like one-on-one conversations to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I need an out. I need, like, a timeline that can be movable, but, like, you know, I got to do my laundry in, like, 2 hours. Like, you know, I wouldn't say that because that's just that's rude. But
you're like, I've got time.
But, you know, like, I get a little bit anxious over having one-on-one conversations unless I have something to do with my hands. Like, I'll literally invite a friend over and be like, hey, I got to clean my living room. Or, like, I got to fold my laundry. Or, like, I got to paint today. Like, are you down to just bring your laptop with you and do some work? And so, like, I get anxious, like, the concept of going and sitting across from someone at a coffee or something. Wow. Because I just fear that, like, it's going to dry up and you're not going to know what to say. And then I'm going to start saying something stupid. Like, I don't know. Like, and I wasn't like that before COVID, I don't think.
Hmm.
I've also noticed that I don't talk to Uber drivers as much anymore.
Oh, no.
Been like a huge change, because I used to have some really interesting conversations with Uber drivers. I mean, a lot of them are now just, like, on the phone talking to people. And I just think that that's, like, you know, they just are on their headsets. I'm like, go off. Like, you're driving all day. That's fine. But, like, I used to talk to way more people. I just think in general, out in the world, I used to talk to more people. And since COVID, that's completely changed.
Yeah. I definitely tune out a lot more. I used to do a lot of, like, people listening and people watching, like, pre-COVID. Yeah. I used to be like, you know, how I could gather ideas. I'd be like, oh, I listened to this conversation over and, you know, write it down. But I do a lot less of that. I kind of, like, sounds really bad. But I do feel like I avoid people. I also, maybe that's selective.
It's like, it depends on the day too. You know, some days I wake up and I'm really like, I want to socialize today. But like, if I make up in my head that I'm socializing, I'm socializing. If I make up in my head, like if I'm like sitting in my little closet makeup room and I'm debating not going and my brain says you're not going, I'm like, I'm not going. There's nothing you can tell me to get me out of this house. But like, if I'm hell-bent on doing something and like going out and socializing, I'm like, okay, this is my dedicated day of the week. Like, okay, I'm going to do this today and whatever.
I love that though. Yeah. Like, you, yeah, because like with painting and like discovering yourself during the COVID years, what were the big like discoveries for you during the dark times?
You know what is really annoying? I didn't really have a dark time with painting.
Which is amazing for me.
It's annoying for everyone else for say that. Okay. I totally recognize that. So my brother and his now fiance, they just got engaged. Very exciting. Ooh. She's amazing. And they got two cats. They moved in together. And I was like, what do I get them for a housewarming present? And I couldn't really think of anything. And I was like, hey, I'll paint their cats because they love their cats more than anything. And they need some decorations for the new place, whatever. So I painted their cats. And then my neighbor's also an artist. I showed him. And my other neighbor wanted one. And then his sister wanted one of her dog who had passed. And then I posted it on social media. And then more people wanted them. And it just started like, I was like, oh, I guess I have a business now. And then my partner's family dog passed away. And I was like, okay, I want to do one that's a little bit more lifelike. And it was exciting because I was like, whoa, I kind of just fell into a purpose. Like I just fell into something to wake up for in the morning. That's not just acting. And it's insular. I don't have to talk to drunk people. Like I don't, you know, as a server, I hated serving. Like literally at the time that I started painting, I had just been in like two sessions of training for a new bartending position. And literally after the second bartending training day, I got the call for the screen test in Vancouver for this project that I eventually booked. And I also had started this pet, like literally the 2 weeks of that, like just beginning that new job. And I wrote to the girl, I was like, hey, I can't do this serving job. Because like I'm going to Vancouver, I'm busy in other places. And it was like the biggest breath of fresh air because I was like, wow, I don't have to do something I absolutely hate in order to pay the bills. Because that as a life of an actor, you have to do that. And it's such a well-known gig because it's amazing money for like, you know, you can leave and go film for a bit and come back or whatever. But I just wasn't my thing. So painting was something that came into my life at the absolute best time and has been like this saving grace for me that's really taught me a lot about myself and how, you know, I really like that I'm always doing something new. And I mean, that's something I've known for a while. Like I get really bored when it's a mundane thing over and over again. But yeah, painting has been like this awesome little side gig that's come in really instilled me with more creative energy.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, and it's really interesting because, like, you talk about profitability and, you know, like, do you find it's very lucrative or do you find it sort of like, really?
Oh, I don't charge cheap, baby.
Really?
My time is precious. No, and like, so at first I started low because I was like, well, I don't want to like, you know, charge too much and it be whatever. And then my friend was like, quoted me. I was like, so how much? And he's in the arts, like painting, visual arts. I'm like, how much would you charge for this? And he quoted me something that was like 10 times more than what I was charging. Wow. And I was like, no way. And I'm still not charging that much. But I started charging about like 5 times more.
Yeah.
And I'm working my way up because I still feel like I've still got stuff to learn, but it is lucrative because I basically looked at how much I was getting paid to work as an actor And I said, okay, that's funny money. Like that's like in that time, that's only specific, you know. I'm going to take at least a bit closer to that of my hourly. Like, what's my hourly? What am I making when I'm working this other job? I'm probably working harder as a painter than I was as an actor a lot of the time. To a degree, it depends. Some days are like, for example, when Eden gets trapped in the glass in season two, that was really emotionally and physically taxing. Like that, you know, justifies it. But like there's a lot of days that it's very grueling to be on set, and a lot of days that I'm like, hey, sweet, I love this job. You know, I get to like hang out and make friends with the crew. But for painting, I'm like, if I'm painting straight through for an hour, 2 hours to 10 hours plus on a project for one person, I need to make it lucrative for myself. I have to be able to pay my bills with something that I'm spending that much time doing.
So I love that though. I think that's really like empowering. Because yeah, it's funny. I think that the thing most artists, and I definitely know from my you know, like my wife's side of the family, like they're a bunch of artists, and that, but you know, some of them don't use it as a lucrative business. They just go, oh, I like doing this.
Totally. And I so support that, because I think that actually brings us to a really interesting point I've been talking to some people about recently, where in COVID, there was this perfect opportunity for people to do art for the sake of art and not for monetizing. And a lot of people took that opportunity and monetized it and lost the joy of art. And I think that starts at a young age in school, when the talented ones are separated from the academic ones, and the academic ones, who we all started drawing, like, you know, with paints and stuff when we were kids, we all started as artists to a degree as kids because we didn't care. And there were no, there was no, you know, expectations as artists when we were kids. So it was just have fun and enjoy your process and find joy in it, whatever. But that it's like, oh, you're good at it, so like, let's push you down the artist realm. You're not good at it, let's throw you into the academic box, right? And in COVID, people are like, well, I'm not working right now, I'm not doing anything, I'm consuming art, which we're giving, like the artist box is giving you. But it's like, how can the academics were able to experience what art was for the first time, which I think was really cool. And that needs to be more of like a thing, to just do art for the sake of art. You don't have to monetize it. I'm monetizing it because as an actor, an actor's life is not lucrative for the majority of it. It's really not. It's hard to make money as an actor, because when you make money, but then you have to make it last for potentially years of not working. So for a bit, I was like, oh, maybe I'm not going to make this into a business. And then I was like, no, I enjoy doing this and I can make money from it. I'm going to monetize it because I, you know, like that's amazing. But I think that there should always be some kind of outlet. Like right now, music is that for me. Like music is my non-lucrative joy of artistic expression. But yeah, I think everyone's different when it comes to that. And I've just chosen to really like, I'm going to ask for my this amount. And if someone, my friend to me said to me, if people aren't fighting you on your prices, you're not charging enough. And I was like, that kind of feels like a dick move. Like, and he was like, no, Halia, that's because you think that like you have to put value behind what you're making, because no one else will put value unless you put value on it when it comes to art.
I 100% agree with that. I think it's also something that I've really taken a step forward in, just being like, you know, because I'm very similar to you, you know, like, but with photography particularly, that that can be quite lucrative. It can also be not, depending on like people's restraints and budgets and stuff like that. But I think particularly one thing that I really believe in, and something I remember, I listened to another podcast actually about this, which is, you know, we were talking about like a lot of headshot photographers and a lot of like stylistic photographers, and the podcast was like, put in your contract. And I started doing contracts this year to really kind of like sign off and say, this is my style, this is what I charge, mm-hmm. this is what I do. And I remember one of the contract elements, he was like, put on, people need to understand your style and they can't ask you to be someone else.
Mm.
He was like, very specifically, put in your contract, say, this is my style. I do not, you know, and particularly for me, I don't change like skin tones, like I color correct and like make it look nice, but I'm not going to be like, get rid of acne that's exist. Like, I'm like, I'm not removing something that's physically on you.
Yeah.
Like, that I don't think is a fair, like, that's my choice and that's my style. And I remember particularly, like, you know, some people were like, I really want to, you know, get rid of this like sweat stain. I'm like, oh, that's fine, I can do that. But, you know, like, I'm not going to completely change your appearance to like make you glow. And they were like, oh. And I was like, it clearly says in my contract. Like,
no, that's just your style. That's like what you want to do. If you want something different, if you want to change your appearance in any way, then go find someone else.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is like, when you are something, they want, and this is the client rather than us as artists, but there's always this, and this is why, like, I remember particularly this year, we were going through my dad's affairs and going through one of his boxes. I found out, like, he had a contract, which I'd never seen before, because obviously, like, he had never, when he was alive, he never went and kind of said, here's all my stuff. Like, he was very much like, oh, I'll keep my business to myself. But I remember he had a contract once when he was doing photos at a beach, and he had to get people to sign it because he was like, well, you're in the photo.
Yeah.
So I have to have your consent to sell it.
Yeah.
And it stated, like, this really clear, like, statement of, like, what the photo was going to be used for, what, you know, like, so on and so forth. And I really thought, and I remember, like, he told me about his career and how, like, so many, like, I remember he would deal with, like, PR people and how he hated PR people. Like, he thought PR people were the worst. And I remember so many times he would tell me this. And I actually discovered when I did contracts and stuff, you know, like, and some agents hate, you know, certain contracts, they go, oh, I won't sign that. I'm like, why? It clearly, you know, like, this is the most laid out thing.
Yeah.
And it's the most helpful thing, because you and I know
the
clarity. But it's down to, and this is why I think it's so hard to break the industry as a photographer and as an artist, is because there's always someone who's been doing it for 30 years.
Of course.
And everyone knows is amazing. And they're like, oh, well, they'll go with this person, like, you know, because this is the well-known one. And I'm like, but what about, like, I know I'm good.
Yeah.
So why isn't that?
Well, we can always ask, why not me, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've opened Instagram and I've seen a Deadline article of, you know, a well-known actor got a role that I auditioned for 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Often. I've seen it a few times where it's been Nepo babies, and, like, to each their own. Like, if a Nepo baby's doing good work, like, good work is good work. I don't care. If they're not doing good work, I'm a little bit
bitter.
You know. To each their own. Like, they can try what they want to try. And, like, I have a friend whose father is very well known in the industry, and he's really doing well for himself. But he does what he can to just not be seen as that man's son, like, he, because he wants to be known for himself. And he's just an amazing person and does amazing work. And so for me, like, I need to, like, say it's not always gonna be me, and that's okay. And, like, there's so many reasons why not. But, like, for things that I'm comfortable with, like, for my paintings, for example, getting back into that, like, someone asked me to do, like, a portrait of a person and a dog. And I was like, I could try that, but, like, I don't do people. Like, that's not what I do. But I considered it, because I was like, well, I want to, like, do what they want. And I was like, unless you pay me more for this, because it's something that, like, this is not my typical thing. Like, it kind of felt like they were expecting me to do it for free. And I was,
yeah.
I was like, I'm not going to try, you know, something for you for free. Like, that's not worth my time. And I don't have a contract, but that's a contract I have to have for myself, of my self-worth and my value and my time, which is really difficult as artists, because in the essence of what value is, it's different for everyone, right? of, you know, if I paint you a pet portrait, it's going to have no value to our sound guy. Like, it's, you know, I know you're more than a sound guy, but like, it's, there's value for everyone that's different, right? And I just have to make that contract with myself that I value my time for this, 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 and this, and I'm not going to, like, I'm not going to sway on that.
Yeah. Which I 100% agree, and I think it's, like, something, like, that really makes me think quite highly of the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And
as you should.
My favorite ever. I mean, like, you know, it's, I will, you know, edit the photos, and one of my favorite things is to always, like, color correct and stuff. But I remember someone, I always think, and I clearly state this to, you know, like, when you do a photo shoot, you, before you hand over the files, and this is my firm belief, that I was like, okay, well, I'm going to show you the low res to be like, these are not the final, like, high res files. Mm-hmm. You don't get those until pay.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and some of my friends are also like, if you book me, I get half a deposit.
Of course.
And I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. And I had someone recently be like, oh, they liked my photos, but they didn't like how I edited them. And so they wanted a refund. But, and I was like, well, no, like, I've delivered that's my work. That's you know, that. But they were like, well, I'm not happy. So, you know, like, I want to get someone else to edit them. And I'm like, I'm like, that's kind of where you go into an icky.
It's a weird spot.
Yeah,
to be in.
I know. And I'm always like of the belief of like, don't hire someone or like, and waiver.
Yeah.
You know, like the dollar sign. I mean, like this person was also a friend of mine, so it was a little bit different.
That's really awkward.
Yeah, and I was like, but I think the complication was originally I was just trying out. Like, I was not even thinking these were going to be good photos. Like, I was like, and I had offered the situation, be like, I'm going to do this for nothing. And she was like, oh, I kindly want to pay you for your time.
Oh,
I was
like,
that's
awkward.
Fine.
That is,
but
really
then
awkward.
She didn't like how they were edited. So I was like, well, this is an awkward situation because it's like, I respect you as a...
Well, could you have, like, that's when you have to say, like, how would you, like, the if you want them changed, like, let's have a discussion rather, like, a black or white situation, right?
But it was very black and white. There wasn't, like, I said, hey, let's have a Zoom chat or let's have a convo. No, none of that. So it's very...
Awkward.
I mean, like, and I remember thinking about this and going, like, there are some times, like, people just, it doesn't matter. You know, they just, they're never going to be happy with something or you do the best product. Like, I remember, like, another one of my friends had done a movie poster for someone, had said, this is the amount that I charge. And the person was like, no worries, I'll take it. And then got the, you know, the low res and was like, oh, I'm not paying that. This is only worth this. And he was like, no.
But that's the thing is, like, value is different for everyone. And that's why you have to stay true to your value.
Yes.
Right.
And that it's
not waver on that.
No, but some people are very like.
Of course, you're going to find bitches everywhere. Like, you're going to find so many difficult people. And usually the most difficult people are the ones who are trying to get the discount.
Yeah.
Not the people who are willing to pay full price because they trust that your work is going to be exactly what they're looking for. And, like, it's so well known. It's so well known in the art and the industry in general that, like, the people who are looking to get that discount are always going to be the most difficult.
Mm. I remember, like, the best deal I've ever gotten, and one of my best friends to this day lives over in LA. And recently I got married, which is very exciting for him. But I remember we were starting out in films together. He needed, like, he was like, oh, I can't do freebies for you. Like, and I was like, okay, well, what's a fair amount? And he was like, I can do $50 a day to do sound for you. And I was like,
really,
are
good.
You sure? And he was like, yeah. You know, we've known each other for, you know, a couple of years at this point. And I was like, oh, okay, if you're happy with that. He was like, yeah, if you can just swing me 50. I was like, that is enough for petrol, food, everything. You know, like, he was happy. And I remember, like, now he does dialogue editing for a bunch of shows and stuff like that. But I remember he was just, he is always, like, still to this day, been like, oh, if you need something done for, like, low key or nothing, just be wary, like, that if a big project comes up, I need to take that as priority because that's, like, where my money comes from.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I am not doubting that. And that's the thing. It's like, it's an open conversation. He's not going, oh, I'm going to screw you around.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, if you don't have a fixed deadline, that kind of makes my life easier.
Yeah.
And whereas, like, you know, if a Netflix show, like, yeah, he did Cowboy and Bebop, I think 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, like, yeah, that took up, like,
of course,
like,
yeah,
so much of his time.
Well, that's the same with me, is that, like, if I were to make a contract, I would say, like, it's hard because, like, Christmas season is coming and everyone wants everything. And a lot of people aren't even thinking about what they are going to get for Christmas. So I'm probably going to get, like, an influx of messages being like, pay my dog for my partner. And, like, like December 12th.
Yeah.
And I simply am like, I'm not doing that. But if I were to do some kind of contract, it would be like, I can promise you within, like, a month to a 2 month range.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do them less than that. I just, unless there's, like, an express order or there's a reason you need it within the next 2 weeks. But 2 months is, like, for me, like, I don't know what's happening in my life. Like, I can't promise anything. If a show comes up, that's priority.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And, like, I don't have my dates yet for December for this new project, but, like, I'm trying my hardest to try to get everything done before I potentially get a call saying, like, hey, you have to fly out to Vancouver in, like, 4 days to start this project. And I'm like, oh, well, I have, like, 8 paintings to do. So I can't put – I've promised them already it's going to be there by Christmas. But, like, in general, it's, like, if something else comes up that's, like, my main focus in my career, my number one focus in my career is acting.
Mm.
It's not painting.
No. But so, It's and I think that's, you know, the reason I love that as well. It's like, you know, it's lucrative, it's fun for you, and then also you got the music, which is nice little, like, fun things.
Yeah.
But then you're like, I would, you know, you'd be kidding yourself to be like, okay, well, this is all, like, the, you know, it's like, well, I've got this big gig on this movie or this show, and then just be like, I need to focus on that, like, you know, and the same thing goes for anyone. And I think this is really, like, this is down to, like, also just, like, the type of personality you got. I think it's very, like, you know, structurally, when we get excited for things, but then we prioritize other things, just being transparent is better than being like, 100%. Oh, I, you know, and, but some people, you know, like, people, going back to bitches be bitches kind of thing in the industry, like, I think the best people to work with are genuinely the people who are on the same page as you. They're like, they're like, okay, you know.
But it is, there is something to be said about people who aren't on the same page but are willing to flip their own.
Yeah.
And also you being willing to flip your own in a way to, like, understand both pages and, like, see how you can learn from their perspective and why they're on a different page from you. If they're stubborn enough to never flip that page, then that's not going to be a cohesive work environment at all.
I think it also shows that, like, the skill set of us as artists, though, it's like knowing, going back to that value thing, and knowing, like, you know, like, our worth and our value.
Mm-hmm.
If someone said to you, hey, Halia, you're not, like, up here, you'd be like, well, fuck, I know I am. Like, I know I'm, you know, like, I'm not going to believe you because I have, like, goes back to that self-value and knowing. And I think that comes also from a resilience of ADHD and the neurodiverse, like, thought process, because we work in such a way and in such a unique way that is hard. Like, and I think I've never done anything, like, under 110%. So I get very, like, and one of the things I think that's also thrown around, like, post-COVID is the word, like, people don't know what the word professional means anymore, which I feel is a very, like, you know, because the amount of, you know, like, one of the things I have to deal with is reading a lot of emails in my day job. And even outside, like, I write, you know, like, I'll make sure the email sounds professional, like, all these things. The amount of responses sometimes I get from people who are not the most professional response, mm-hmm. or have sometimes been like really quite badly phrased.
Yeah.
Or they like they're, you know, they, you know, like, so, you know, people don't like cold emails. You know, sometimes you get rude responses.
Yeah.
And I'm like reading it going, what the fuck? Like, yeah. you know, like I'm like, you're meant to have your shit together. Like, yeah. you're meant to be like.
But here's the thing. No one does.
No.
No one does. No one has their shit together. And anyone who thinks that people, everyone should, like, that's the thing, though. Like, no one has their shit together. That is one thing to, like, write a proper email. But I also think that Gen Z is influencing that, and it's just like, you know, they're really saying it how it's no fluff, yes. you know. But everyone is so uncertain on what they're doing that they're all kind of. I feel like a lot of us are just like throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a lot of like so many people's experiences.
I definitely agree with that. I think it's also it's sort of exciting and also petrifying at the same time. Because, mm-hmm. like, the one thing I love, you know, getting to do things like this, which mm-hmm. is, you know, one of my favorite things to do, is sitting down mm-hmm. and being like, oh, having an open conversation. How that, you know, ever develops. I mean, like, I knew the day we first spoke, I knew it was going to go like a house on fire. But I do think that I've definitely had my fair share of, like, people, I'm like, I don't know how this is going to pan out, or yeah. I don't know if this person's going to like the experience. And yeah. that is like just the tumultuous like nature of being an interviewer. I remember like particularly, not that this ever happened to me, but listening to like other interviewers like mm-hmm. who have had bad experiences with guests or like stuff like that. You do hear the horror stories of just like someone going, and I remember like this was when I worked for TV. We had. Like, especially when you're known, this is the funniest thing, when you're known for something throughout mm-hmm. your career that doesn't leave you, even when you're 80. Like, yeah. your entire career is based upon, like, this one thing you did when you were 20, and everyone wants to talk about that because that's the thing they remember you, the highlight of your career. And
my mom once said to me, she was like, you know, maybe Lock and Key was it. You don't know. And I'm like, I refuse to have that come true because she was trying to support me. Yeah. She was like trying to like, you know, because I was like, oh my God, I haven't booked anything. And this was before I booked this project. And like, that was the scariest thing, but continue on.
Oh, no, yeah. I love that. But that's my point. Like this one artist who had done heaps of stuff and all this interview. And it was like with like this really refined journalist. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, I just, you know, like, the guy stormed out and he was like, I don't want to talk about this. Like, if you don't want to ask me.
I mean, there are certain things that, like, if they storm out, like, with, I think, like, Robert Downey Jr., the guy kept on pushing on something he didn't want to talk about. And, like, that's totally justified, I think.
Oh, 100%. Like, if you yeah. don't want to talk about it. But, like, this was, like, he had been asked by different news channels about this one thing he had done, like, 50 yeah. years ago. Where it was like, he was like, I've moved on. Like, it was just, like, a funny story.
Yeah.
And he was, oh, like, a funny role he'd done, and everyone was like, oh, yeah. we remember you from this film. And he was like, why are people still talking yeah. about this? I've like done heaps since then.
I mean, that would be annoying though, because yeah. you know, repeating the same things over and over again does get taxing, because there's not really any other, like, what other occupation has that, right? Yeah. And imagine, like, I've done press calls and press circuits, and I haven't done enough of them to like hate myself for them. You know, like, you know, when it gets to the point where you're like, they're checked out. Like, we've all seen press circuit videos yeah. of people who are checked out. And I'm like, I feel for them. Yeah. I really genuinely do, because I have been in them where, like, how many times have I been asked, if you could make a key, what key would you make? Like, for Lock and Key, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you could, like, and I think that's what I find separates good journalism and kind of, like, pop journalism, where it's, like, there's a lot of, like, the questions which are just regurgitated, or they aren't thought through, And then like a journalist comes around and asks you a question you've never been asked. And so I understand, to counter your point of like, of why actors would storm out, or I mean, storming out is a bit dramatic, but, or just like get fed up with it because it's like, can someone ask me something else? Or like, can someone, can we talk about what I'm doing right now? Especially if a journalist is asking questions about a project that they did like years ago when they're trying to promote something new. Yeah. And they're trying to start something new and they're trying to like move on from where they were in the past. It's like, as an actor, you kind of get stuck in that a lot of times. And I think that's also a part where I've in my brain kind of justified, not justified, but like accepted that Eden gets killed off in like the end of season two. And it wasn't like a 5-6 season thing. We only did 3 seasons, but I'm really glad that Lock and Key was as big as it was and I got the role that I got, because I think if it was any bigger and if the role went on for any more seasons, that's the character I would be seen as for years. And I think Eden was enough of time where I feel like I got my foot in the door. I got an opportunity to show the skills that I have to the world, and I got to have fun, make connections, you know, do the work. But it didn't keep it. I don't think it has a chokehold on me, because I think like I went and did We Forgot to Break Up by Karen Knox, and that was like a small indie production that shot up in North Bay, and it was incredible. And I had a shaved head, dyed manic panic pink. Like, it was so cool to be able to do something that was completely the opposite of Eden, because now it's like, I don't think that 20 years from now, I'm only going to be asked about Lock and Key. Like right now, it makes sense to be asked about Lock and Key. I'm not getting on you about that. But like, it makes sense, because that's the most notable thing I've done. And I recognize that 100%. But like I said at the very beginning of this, like, I'm just at the beginning of my career. And like, I think every time I get asked about Lock and Key, I'm happy to talk about it. But if someone was asking me about it like 20 years later, that an interviewer 5 minutes before had also asked me about it, like, that'd be freaking annoying, you know? Because people are ever evolving, and to be constantly be brought back into something that you did years and years and years ago, it kind of stunts evolution of human character, because you're constantly being pinned as that person at that. And people just see you as that. Like, watching Lord of the Rings, and like, you know, I knew Orlando Bloom from Pirates of the Caribbean. Amazing. He also did those within years of each other, like within like 2 years. He was doing Lord of the Rings and Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, man had a great time. But like, you know, I don't just see him as Legolas. Like, I don't see, like, but he'll be brought up as Legolas because it's an iconic franchise. And he's happy to talk about it because it was an amazing experience. So there's like a scale to which, like, I think it makes sense that someone would be like, oh my God, stop asking me about it. But I'm still at the place in my career where I'm like happy to.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But I just think that's kind of like the joy of looking back, and also like something I can't wait, you know, when I'm 70.
100%. And there is so much joy to looking back. It's just how many times.
Oh yeah, 100%. You know? And I think like, to summarize it, I think Hugh Grant did it the best when he was promoting Wonka. And he said, like, I'm at that stage of my career where I play an Oompa Loompa. And that is like, he was like,
I don't care.
Yeah. I do weird roles now. And he recently did Heretic.
That's the Mormon girls come to the door, right? I don't like scary movies.
He's brilliant in that.
I know, I've seen the trailer and stuff, but it looks freaky, like with the blueberry pie candle and stuff. Like, oh my God. And he's the last person I would have thought to do a horror film, but I think that's why he's doing it.
Yes.
You know?
And he was the first person, I watched the press junket for that, and he was the first person brought on for it. And they were like, we need someone good to play the villains. And he just, like, he sells it. That's the thing. And I love that he's gone from, like, that's how he's redefined his career. He's gone from this dashing young really like
he's still dashing.
Oh, he's still dashing.
Oh my god!
But apparently, like they the best story out of it was he said in an interview. He said, "Oh, with the my two co-stars, we went out to dinner after we'd shot everything, and we were suddenly all out of character, how we dressed, like everything, and." They were just taken aback with how nice he was because he's so manipulative and evil in the film.
Yeah.
And but they were like, "You're just so lovely."
Yeah.
And he was like, "Oh, you're not as you know." His two co-stars grew up Mormon, and he was like, "Oh, you're not as kind of like religious or you know more you know like a Mormon." And it was just so interesting because he talked about it so fondly, and he was like, "It was the sort of like best experience."
Yeah.
And that's a set. That like you can tell even and this is a thing I always agree with and you know is you can tell when people loved working with each other on sets.
Oh yeah,
that is a set that everyone just had a blast. Like the hours were worth it. The film is like I could rant about how good that film is, but you know, I think there's very certain things that when you look at career milestones and some of my you know like some things that I've considered my best work are the ones where I go. That was a great experience because I felt like everything kind of fell into place.
Yeah.
And it's like this joyous, you know, and I think that's also like maybe why there's a, probably an element for Locke and Key going to stick around for you, which will, you know, when you have other roles as well, you might have like a category, like, a, you know, every like, you know, there might be like per decade, but you might be like, everyone remembers Locke and Key because it was that sort of like time.
Yeah.
And then everyone remembers this other project that I did, you know, when I was, you know, 30 something or, you know, 40 something or, you know, like wherever you are in your timeline. And I think that's really cool because you can kind of be like, it's like those variety things where people look back at their career and they go, oh, this is what I did when
which is so cool, and that's my goal. One day I want to be on the Variety. One day I want to be sitting down in Variety going through my life, going through all of like the looks, all of the outfits. You know, like I watch those videos and I was like, yeah, that's my future. I just hope, I hope, because that is so my thing. I want to be like, because like I, outfits for me, and I know this is a little bit of like a random term, but like outfits for me are like emotions, experiences. And even like the Locke and Key outfits, this is actually an Eden sweater. Who can figure out where it came from? but like, I can remember why we chose it, how it came to be, like how it felt to wear it in that scene and why and blah, blah, blah. And like, that's kind of the thing where like I look at those Variety like interviews and I'm like, wow, that's such an important part of life is those different milestones and like how you're dressing in that time, at least for me, because clothing is important to me. It's just like, wow, those different milestones that you hit through your life. But yeah, one day, Variety.
I believe.
Also, the round table, the
yes, I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, Hollywood Reporter round table.
I would, I believe it. Halle, one day. I believe it.
Thank
I believe
you.
It.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to wrap us up, though.
That's okay.
I could talk to you all day, though. Like, you're, like, so much fun.
I'm a chatter. I'm a yapper. I like to yap.
I think that's great. My final question for you, though, is where can people find you on the internet? Where can they stalk you?
I love how you ask that, because what else is it, you know?
Yeah, I know. What else is
like,
it?
Truly. Primarily my Instagram. At Halleia Jones, HalleiaJones. And primarily on my stories. I don't like posting to my main feed a lot. It gives me anxiety. I just feel like Instagram has taken a really weird turn with Reels. Does. Like I started in 2017, 2015 or something. And it's just been really, really weird. So I like to hide in my stories. I guess Twitter doesn't exist anymore. And I actually have a Threads account, which is cool because it's like primarily like females and like gals talking about gal things, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. It's very queer forward. It's very like welcoming. It's just like, I just love it. It's just amazing. I get stuck on there a lot as of recently. That's why I say it, because I'm like, I've spent too much time. But yeah. Instagram's my primary.
Oh my god, I love this. Yeah. Well, everyone go and stalk Halleia.
If honestly, I have like almost 1,000 posts or something. If you go down, I've taken out the things that I don't want people to see. If you go down, you could see like so many chapters of my life.
I'm gonna
like
I'm
my
gonna stalk
Instagram
this.
Is. I'm not even kidding. Like I won't even be like weirded out because like I support it because I have so much interesting life on my Instagram. It's crazy.
Oh my God.
So yeah, that's how you can stalk me. Just well, don't be weird about it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
This has been so much fun.
Yeah.
And if you want to go and check out more episodes of The Things We Do, you can check them out on Apple and Spotify. I'll be speaking with another guest next week, and I'll speak to you later. Goodbye.
Bye.